Greetings and welcome to Don't Call It Jazz, KISU's very own listening hang from a jazz musician's perspective. I am your host, Jonathan Armstrong. I'm a professional jazz musician and a professor of music at Idaho State University. Tonight's episode is the second half of a conversation that I recorded with Dan Atkinson, a brilliant and wise jazz historian and musician. Dan and I met in the University of Washington in Seattle in the mid-aughts when we were going to school together. I was getting an undergraduate degree in jazz studies, performance, and he was getting a doctorate in ethnomusicology, his dissertation being field recordings and the historical context of those field recordings from Angola State Prison, a state penitentiary in Louisiana that still functions or used to function as a legitimate slave plantation. It's a real troubled part of our American history, and he went there, visited the prison, and did field recordings of different gospel quartet a cappella songs of the prisoners. We talk a little bit about that in this interview. In addition, we chat about jazz academia. We talk about the state of the United States, which I think is fairly appropriate during this election week, this very, very long election week. Talk about the racial elements of jazz's history and jazz's current state. Talk about a whole host of things, and we also talk about some wonderful music and play some wonderful music. I asked Dan before we recorded the interview to pick some of his favorite jazz tunes, and the first two sets he chose were played in last week's episode, which if you're curious, you can go check out at KISU.org and find Don't Call It Jazz's archives. And then this third set we'll listen to in a little bit after you hear us gab for a while. And then at the very end, we go out on a really great Gary Bartz recording, and we talk about all that as well. I'm biased because I'm a good friend of his, but he's just one of the most impressive people I've ever met. I owe a lot of just the way that I see the world to him and those conversations that we would have in his apartment listening to jazz recordings back in Seattle 20 or 15 years ago, I guess. Just a real brilliant man. And he comes at it as a Black American, having spent a lot of time in Los Angeles and the Bay Area, in addition to Seattle, having spent a lot of time in the South, working with the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. The man's lived a lot of lives, and he's just really one of the most impressive and brilliant people I know. So I hope you enjoy all of his wisdom, all of his stories, and all the things that he has to share. And I'm just totally honored to play this interview for you, the listener. As I said last week, this second half is similar to last week in that I edited together an incredibly long conversation that we had. And so right now what you're about to hear is us just jumping right into why he chose the songs and the third set that you'll hear in just a little bit. So without further ado, I present an hour of conversation and music with the incomparable Dan Atkinson.
But for the last set, like those I chose, because that was the music that I was listening to when I first got on the scene in Los Angeles in 1992, and I was just starting to try to figure it out for myself, you know. And that was when the Young Lions of the 80s were really coming into their own, that being Greg Hutcherson, Marsalis Brothers to some extent, but they had come in the 70s and much earlier. That for me, that was what attracted me to jazz, was I could see these younger Black men doing something intellectual, rebellious, at times sexual, uniquely Black, and they weren't having to grab their junk to do it. Hmm. They weren't having to take any real risks with the political system or with they didn't have to sort of fit a mold that was inequitable. They found their own way to do it, and they could do it and have fun and style. And so that's why I used to follow like guys like James Mahone and Marcus Shelby and those cats around a lot that were, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years older than me. Roy Hargrove was another one. Darren Barrett was another. Mark Carey, Greg Hutchison, all those dudes. I would just take every opportunity to hang with them and to learn from them. Again, sometimes examples of what not to do, but for the most part, they were doing what I wanted to do, and they were hanging out with the old cats and getting knowledge and playing like nobody else in the world, you know? So I took every opportunity to kick it with those cats. So the first one I picked for this this set being Roy Hargrove, and we recently lost him, but he truly was the epitome of that vibe of that rowdy, raspy, all up in your face trumpet player who could throw down and then play the most beautiful, breathy, waste-in-air ballad you could ever imagine with these corny little frills coming through. It was like, wow, this guy listened to Luther Vandross, you know?
He did. And it goes back to what we were talking about, like the vocal tradition. Like he listened to Luther Vandross and probably Patti LaBelle and probably Roberta Flack. I mean, there's a lot of...
Roy was always like punching above his weight. Like Nat Adderley was like the feisty one of the Adderley brothers, you know?
Yeah.
And that feistiness really, it was such a beautiful thing. And then for that song, Roy Allen from Family from 1995, to this day, that is still a Desert Island record for me. One of my favorite jazz recordings was made in 1995. And Roy, like especially like the tenors of our time, where he had Joe Henderson, he had Stanley Turrentine, he had the Cats come through. Mm. And they all do stuff together, and you can hear how much fun they're having. And that whole thing, that vibe on Family and that tune Roy Allen written for his father, you can still hear that continuity that goes all the way back, particularly because he's looking back. And it's just really good stuff and just one of my favorite things. And I consider myself really lucky to have been on the scene when that dropped, when it was new, and to really see him in those Cats and be around him and learn from him. And another one that's in the second song would be The Swing and I with Eric Reed. So that one's just popping back when Motown was still trying to do some jazz. And that's got Ben Wolfe with his big old heavy hands and on bass, and Greg Hutchison, who's on both of those songs. Mm-hmm. And Greg is like the poppinest, swinginest. His personality off stage, because he's a guy that I spent quite a bit of time with in the 90s when he would come to the Bay. He was friends with my buddy Jamal Ramirez, and we would drive Jamal's drums down for him to play down at Yoshi's. And Greg would bring his cymbals, Jamal would bring the drums, and we would set everything up. He would come meet us for sound check. We'd get to hang out and see the sound check when he was playing with Ray Brown. Wow. And then we'd go back to the hotel room and we'd kick it until it was time for them to hit. And just... every time I'd see him, something crazy would be going. I was like, is this how you live? Like, your life is crazy, dude. And it was always so much fun. And then, of course, the scene got sour for me around 2002 or so. And I went to graduate school, and that's where we met. Mm-hmm. And the year I finished my dissertation, I was with Howard at the Monterey Festival because he was playing with Chester Thompson. And, so I was like, oh, cool, I'll come down. So I came down and just like, it was like, oh, wow, everything still looks the same. It's the same people, too. It's the trip. Because I hadn't been on the scene in like 10 years. Mm. And cats like Hutch, McBride, and like Redman were like, man, we thought you was dead or like locked up or something. It's like, no, man, I just couldn't take it. I wasn't as talented as y'all. So I had to find something else to do.
Went to Seattle.
Yeah. But Greg especially, he was like, man, there's not enough of us, man. You shouldn't have just left the way you did. And I didn't realize that I had gotten to know these people and they got to know me, and like, you know, like he missed me. That was his way of saying that he missed me. And that was a trip, you know. Just to be like, wow, man, this guy's a cat, you know, and he said he liked having me around. Like that was a major boost for the ego.
I like that. It also speaks to this whole thing about community, where it's like, it's not this whole thing of like just going to the master for 4 years during a degree and like kind of picking what you can and then leaving, which is sort of like a modern academic way of doing it, as opposed to actually like being a community member. So if you do Irish farewell them, they're going to be mad at you. Like that's like a different kind of interaction with the music.
Right. And I didn't even think about it that way because I had this weird icon master apprentice kind of relationship with them, to where I've had other people like sort of like dip out and then pop back in. You're like, man, where have you been? What's wrong with you? I thought you was dead, man. Yeah. And I didn't even think that I was doing that to them because I didn't think of myself as being important to them, you know?
Sure.
Which was a trip. And so that's why I would like to pay homage to those cats. So Eric Reed, who That is the, he's the churchiest church boy to ever church boy on the piano. He is such a church boy. And man, he's got that sound, that vibe, that man.
There's a little monk in there. Not that he's stealing anything, but the danger. Like the danger of Monk and the kind of rhythmic thing that he does, especially on this recording, Swing and I, like, yeah, there's definitely gospel in there, but, and obviously Oscar Peterson and all that kind of stuff, but he has a danger to him that a lot of quote unquote modern, cause this recording came out in 95, but modern pianists, they don't have that sense of everything could go wrong at any moment. Like he's really on top of what he's playing.
Right, but it's coming by so fast that like there's almost no time to fall apart. Just keep moving, dude. Keep moving, you know.
Because the bass and drums are going to railroad you on this song. Yeah,
run right over you. Right, Greg and Ben is like popping, and then Greg is like popping too. Then they're just like, yeah, they're just going to run right over you. So you got to keep running. It's like you're trying to leave a club that's on fire. You're being like cordwood stacked up by the entrance.
You know? You know, when I was looking up this song, I was kind of researching it. You know the young pianist Christian Sands? He plays with Christian McBride's trio.
Right.
He's a great player. He's been playing this song. I saw a couple recordings of him playing it, which I thought was cool because you don't hear the Swing and I. No one calls it. It's a great song, but it hasn't really become a standard like Roy Allen has and a lot of Roy Hargroves has. I mean, there's music that's been recorded in the 90s that people call. But I like that. I think that's a really cool thing that Christian's doing. Like he's keeping that song alive. And he's such a wonderful player. It's nice to hear it in his hands. It's worth checking out.
Right. And it makes sense because as far as I'm concerned, as far as I know, like the 90s was the last time where cats would write songs that would really become hits in the jazz world and the stuff that people remember. You know, like Roy Allen is one of it's kind of a trip. Even the Darren Barrett piece we have in here, Where Dr. Bird, there's lots of cats in the Academy setting who like that piece because of the way that it works. But that was him paying homage to Donald Byrd, who had showed him some love the way Donald Byrd had done for like 50 years, helping all these younger musicians come through the same way Dizzy had done before him, you know?
That song, Word Dr. Bert, I hadn't heard it before. And just to say this, like one of the things that I always cherish about hanging out with you is there's definitely a few names on this list that I hadn't heard of. Like we talked about Curtis Amy in the last set. I didn't know Curtis Amy. The guy's incredible. And Darren Barrett, I'd heard of before, of course, but I don't know. I'd never done a deep dive to it. And this recording is so amazing. His trumpet sounds so powerful. And it's just a constant one of a million reminders that this world of jazz is so much deeper than the sort of lionized people that we want to put on bronze busts. Like here's it's Coltrane and it's Miles and it's X, Y, and Z. And that's it. Like, no, it's actually all these people that were on the scene, Curtis Amy and Darren Barnett and Barrett. And it's like knowing these people and knowing how they interacted like socially with the scene and who they recorded with and who they went on to record with. It's an important thing. Like if every little recording's a small piece of a puzzle, it's important to listen to all of those recordings in order to get a more like nuanced view of the thing.
Right. Cause I didn't really know him personally until I heard the song. Cause I used to work in radio and it came through. I was like, oh, this is cool. And I'd see, especially just coming through. So I just go by the festival and just hang out with him and talk to him. And it would just be like talking to anybody else, particularly because he wasn't famous. Like, especially if like Wayne Shorter was performing with John Patitucci, everyone's paying attention to that. And he's just on the side hanging out. And it's not like he's any less talented. And so I just hang out with those cats and, you know, and we'd sit and talk and like, we talk about arranging. We talk about all different types of modes of expression. He'd break out some sheet music and like write some stuff down for me and give it to me. And really super nice. And just a really pleasant, pleasant dude, like Gerald Cannon and all those dudes during that era. And man, and what really impressed me, especially about that group on that album is John Lamkin, the drummer, whose dad was a jazz musician and wasn't really interested in the music, but had become a really potent hip hop DJ. And then just decided one day that he was going to learn to play the drums and went into his parents' basement and learned how to play the drums.
Wow.
And the confidence and the lilt and the abandonment that he plays with is something that you just, It's not something you can teach. We're just blessed that he decided to play the drums and started doing it. Because after seeing him with Barrett's band, then he toured with Vicente Archer and Donald Harrison for a minute. Mm. And you could see, and then it was Rodney Green as well, another drummer where, God, the rhythm just permeates out of them, you know? I'm just super blessed to be on the scene and to put myself in a position to sort of bask in that while it was happening, because it didn't really survive the millennium all that well.
Yeah. Well, let's come back to that. This is the third set. Roy Hargrove's Roy Allen, Eric Reed's The Swing and I, and then Darren Barrett with Word Dr. Bert. Darren Barrett with his song Word Dr. Bird off the 1999 album First One Up. You are listening to Don't Call It Jazz on KISU, and tonight's episode features an interview with Dan Atkinson, a brilliant jazz historian and musician. And in this next portion of the interview, we talk about Dan's experience as a jazz student at Chico State in California.
You know, I'd be in the Performing Arts Center in a practice room playing, and people would just bust in because I'd be playing along with Louis Jordan or Earl Bostic or something old, you know, some cat who'd been dead for a long time. And first they'd be like, how did you get that sound? Because I love my horn was from the 20s. And I played on large chamber mouthpieces, real hard reeds. And they would like, oh, that horn plays out of tune. Like, no, the horn plays perfectly in tune, and you just heard it play in tune, and you came in to see what was going on with this horn, who was playing the horn. I'm the one who's playing this horn. So it doesn't fit your mold of what you think it should be, but you should realize that and then maybe change your mold. But instead, they would want me to sort of fit into their way of doing things and in turn change what I was doing, even though it was remarkable enough for them to bust in and try to figure out what it was.
But they wanted the math equation to get there. They're like, give me the math equation to get there instead of everything that went into that.
Right, exactly. And I got pretty fond, unfortunately, of saying, this isn't guitar. You can't just buy a pedal and change your tone. You got to practice, dude. And so Howard does the same thing. And I see it to this day when I go with him to jam sessions. Cats will hear him play, and they want to take his mouthpiece and his reed. They want to take everything apart and see if it's something that they can buy and possess. Like, no, man, that's him.
I mean, it's let's say what it is. It's colonialism. It's like, give me the information so that I can take it.
Right.
Like tell me what to buy, what mouthpiece to buy, what reed to buy, what ligature, and then I can take that sound that scared me.
And if you cannot present it to me in a palatable way, I will neutralize you because you have a secret that you are keeping from me, yes, which is unfair because I want that.
And that depression that you talk about, I appreciate you saying it, because jazz schools can be so toxic. Like, there really is this such a competitive element to it, as if there's like win or lose. Because, I think we could talk about that for a while, but I think one of the big reasons is most people fall in love with jazz. Me included, for the most part, because I got so much out of the Buddhist band experience, which was just music for culture and the love of the congregation, so to speak. But so many people get their experience, cut their teeth, and fall in love with this music in competitive jazz festivals. Like that's the competitive jazz festival, that scene, that the industrial complex of
military.
Yeah, it really is, and it feeds this kind of
regimental bands.
It's the what?
It goes back to Sousa and regimental bands.
Absolutely, that whole the infrastructure of the competition. And so when students show up to college, I mean, sometimes even the University of Washington group, we went to a couple competitive jazz festivals, and it still feeds this thing. And I even see it with some of my freshmen that come in that come from schools that did the competitive jazz festival thing. They come in thinking we're going to like learn some sweet Stan Kenton song so that we can impress the judges. And it's like, no, all we do is play in this hall and in this bar, and we just have to bring some kind of authentic human experience for the audience. That's all we're doing. And you can tell it's this almost re-indoctrination of these people that have been these young people that were taught that jazz is some sort of a thing to get over on someone and to win your studio, to win your competition. And so when they heard that thing, they were just thinking like a video game, like, okay, I'm going to go ahead and covet Dan's sound. And then once I get that and I can add it to all my Chris Potter licks, then I'm going to be unstoppable.
And that goes right back, because I saw it in the 80s, because that was my generation, Jamie Abersold records.
Yeah. Because
you could tune people out. And it taught a whole couple of generations of musicians that I am the most important person in this ensemble, and I don't have to listen to anybody else.
What a great point.
And, man, when I worked at the Stanford Jazz Workshop, I could see how these kids was like, and I would get frustrated. And they would say, what are you talking about, man? And I checked all the boxes and crossed all the tie, you know? And I was like, nah, dude, see, following all the rules doesn't make you a good person. Doing the work to be a good person makes you a good person. It was just...
And if I could slip it for just a second, just to explain something to anyone listening, Jamie Ingersoll records are like just the rhythm section background of like a jazz standard, right? So like you want to learn, you know, we listened to Ahmad Jamal's version of Misty. So Jamie Ingersoll put together a pianist and a drummer and a bassist to play just the rhythm section background part to this song Misty, and then a bunch of other standards that you need to know. And then you're supposed to blow on top and you learn all your scales. And so what Dan's talking about is literally you're not interacting with jazz musicians in any authentic way. You're interacting with ghosts, you know, with the CD that you put on. And if you look at the data, a lot of time those Jamie Ingersoll how to play records would outsell like a Miles Davis or a John Coltrane, let alone an Ahmad Jamal album, let alone a Roy Hargrove album.
Right, right. And the thing of it is that not to like really like to poo-poo them too much, because we all used them when we were coming up. They're a useful tool.
Yes.
As long as they don't go from a stereotype to the full definition. They are incomplete, much like a stereotype. And you can't have them stand in for the whole. And so the way I got in trouble for saying this, but for some of the older kids who I thought could benefit from the wisdom that a guy who was a little bit older than them, but was raised generationally way older than them.
Yeah.
It's like the reason why I'm so hard on you when it comes to this is because I can hear how you sound. Because the way that you play in your bedroom with those records, when you can make everything exactly the way that you want, it's like masturbation.
Yes.
Opposed to having a truly beautiful, sexual, spiritual, enlightening encounter with another person where you two become one. That's an entirely different experience than what you're doing here. What you're trying to do is flip a switch. You can't flip a switch. You can't turn other people off and on like that. You've got to create a space for them to fill and wait for them to create a space for you to fill. And you've got to work and negotiate this process together. You have to listen to each other.
I agree. And then it's far more profound than any individual achievement that you could get to by learning all the different things.
And that's the thing that's missing from so much of the music, because people in the United States in particular have demonstrated a willing cultural aversion to anything that is outside or foreign. And for people to hold on to this unearned sense of dominance and superiority with, you know, when coupled with free association, and to say that your mediocre or even sub-mediocre offering is as good or better than the original, and I'm going to call it the same thing, and because I did it, now I'm the king of it, is a disservice to everybody involved, especially you yourself, because you can't call it what you can't call it that thing you're destroying. Mm-hmm. Because it's not the same. Call it something else. And until we get over that, you know, and we wear like face masks to protect other people from what we have, we're never gonna, that is the kind of cancer, that cultural sickness, that lack of a mother to tell us to wash behind our ears is what's going to destroy us from within. And all cultures and civilizations that have crumbled from within have never been reborn. If they've been destroyed from an outward force, they can rebuild, but not when they crumble from within. And that fundamental birth defect that we are now trying to reckon with while trying to exacerbate all at the same time in this very moment in history is the thing that will either make us or break us. We can either really put in the work to ensure that America is on paper what it is in reality, or we can continue to squash people who say America is not all that it claims to be by saying that America is all that it needs to be when it clearly is not. And jazz is an example of the best of us and the worst of us. And it's clear for anyone who has any sense of empathy, sense of knowledge, and critical thinking skills. Because for people to hear Ahmad back in the day and to say the things that they said, or to say that Coltrane was a horrible musician, or the way that they would cap on Lester Young because he didn't sound like Illinois Jacquette, that a black musician shouldn't play so light and fluffy and lilty, And it just stifles our collective potential and our the true essence of what we are as human beings. And that's why I do things the way that I do them, just so that that weird kid who doesn't quite fit in, who could possibly cure cancer or come up with something that everybody loves and finds beautiful in the world, that they are empowered to at least try. Because my grandfather was the most brilliant person I've ever known, born in a sharecropping family. And if not for the American social order, he could have been an Apollo astronaut. Really should have been able to do a whole lot more with his life that could have benefited everybody else around him. So I try to not only maximize my own potential, but the potential of people around me. And I always have busied myself with affirming my own rights by fighting for the rights of others. And jazz is a great vehicle for people who can think in that way, who can experience and create beauty and are willing to take those kinds of risks. And if it's a shame that it looks so cool, because if it didn't look so cool, there wouldn't be so many posers posing, you know?
Yes.
And that's been the trouble with most of the black music that has had a dollar value assigned to it in the 20th century, that it ends up being corrupted in the end because our presence is abhorrent, though it is essential. I mean, they had, you know, Marcus Garvey developed the Black Star Line to take black people to Africa, but we were absolutely necessary in this culture, in this country, as a chief source of labor. So J. Edgar Hoover had to find a way to sabotage these people leaving. We weren't really wanted here, but we weren't really allowed to leave.
Yes.
And that hypocrisy, we have to come to terms with that. Because it's a cancer that will address us if we don't address the cancer. And the worst thing that I see is us infecting children with it who are innocent and are taught to go into this operating system in a way that it's like, wow, even though this person may have a better life on a material level than some brown kid on the other side of the tracks, you're still limiting your child because they're not really able to tap all of their potential if they're taught to just hold on to these benefits that they have not earned. Mm. And to get people to understand that is really difficult. And so when I try to get people to really get that, I say, okay, well, when I go to Japan, I can't say that anyone who's not a jin is a person. So you say, America jin, I'm an American. But as an American, I can't say that I am an America jin because an America jin is white. I have to say koku jin or chairoi jin, mean brown person or tea colored person.
Wow.
Because an American is automatically a white person, and it would really confuse them because that's
even in Japan.
Yeah, in Japan. Wow. That's what that means. It's like locked into this, it's encoded. And
like this conversation about, you know, where people keep on the right, they keep bringing up black on black crime. It's like, you're talking about American and American crime. Like, how come we don't talk, like, I'm Italian, right? Two generations back. How come they don't talk about Italian on Italian crime? They don't. Like, the whole point of calling it black on black crime, as just an example, is to other this group of people even more so, and to further solidify white as default. It's like, we don't talk about Irish American bank robbers, you know, like we don't talk about Italian American drug dealers, but we do talk about black American, but they always leave that second part out.
That cultural aversion to all things black except those that are conspicuously consumable.
Yes, exactly. Which I think these
never benefits us.
Sorry, say that last part.
It never benefits us ever.
Of course, because I mean that's the appropriation that we talk about is, you know, the colonization, like where white people come into a culture and they're not trying to participate in the culture, they're trying to glean from it as if it's a mine or something. And
it's a bar, they take what they want and they just leave the rest. Because it's one thing to condemn me to a bottomless pit by denying my liberty, which creates a sad day for me. But once you know the difference, and if you still choose not to wake from your sleep, then every day is the saddest day of your life.
And
I find that a lot of people choose that when they choose not to recognize these things that are happening in front of us, all around us for hundreds of years. they are choosing sadness.
Yeah.
Because there's so much more beauty if you could just free yourself of that self-imposed repression in nothing. Like what you're trying to protect, it's not earned. It's really not as beautiful as the thing that you're destroying. So why not just go the other way with it?
What I like about the modern framing of structural systemic racism as a public health crisis, because you're right, and James Baldwin writes about this beautifully, this concept of like it destroys the souls of the oppressors. It's not just about black people being disenfranchised or marginalized or minority races being marginalized. It's also, and because white people are so obsessed with ourselves and we like to navel gaze, it's like making it about our own, you know, eroding humanity by, like you say, by this unearned pride that we're born with, that we get addicted to. And I'll say my continuing journey to understand these concepts, which a lot of which, you know, I learned hanging out with you. You would say so many things that would just like shock me as a 20-year-old dumb white kid in Seattle. And I even remember like the people, we won't name them, the people that first introduced me to you, they were like, okay, so Dan's kind of intense. And the things that you were saying in 2003 about like the mass incarceration, nobody was talking about that in 2003, 2004. And now everybody talks about it to the point where like it's part of the Republican platform. Right. But that would have been a very radical thing to say. And I'll say from my experience, it feels a lot like kicking heroin, but like a heroin that you were born into, like this idea of like white pride or white achievement or any of that kind of stuff. It's complete false. It's a hollow crown that we were given that was never earned and was always stolen and cheated out of. Like everyone got mad at the Houston Astros for cheating because they cheated, and we should totally get mad at people that cheat. Well, that basically explains white culture from 1619 to today. It's like, we shouldn't be proud of our forefathers that cheated, you know, speaking as a white person, and learning that feels awful. It's like all this, it feels like it's toxic, but the toxicity is actually inside of you. It's actually the thing that you're eating. All of that knowledge is actually the anecdote, even though it feels like it's the poison.
And this is what we've been doing. I mean, my dissertation is a 21st century slave narrative, and I'm not nearly as good a writer or orator as Frederick Douglass. So in the end, I got really super frustrated because, like, man, if he couldn't solve the problem, I can't solve the problem, you know? And here we are. To this day, and so some of those things that I was talking about, say 15 years ago, that were radical, that are normal now, but because I was deemed a radical back in the day, I'm still not allowed into the conversation to actually try to fix these problems. But no other black person has gone to a gigantic slave plantation to record music and really get people to think critically about the legacy of the 13th Amendment and how it stifles our creative potential. Like, we really need to be working on that, especially in states that are fiscally conservative and worried about wasteful spending. Well, this is wasteful spending on cruel and unusual punishment.
Which just really quickly, so what you're talking about is the Angola Project, and I've played a couple recordings from your Angola Project on this show. I'll continue to, and that inspired the Angola Project. I'm sorry, your dissertation was on Angola State Prison, which inspired the Angola Project by Howard Wiley. But it also, like,
acapella recordings with you?
Say that again?
Have I shared the acapella recordings that I made with you?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh. In fact, I played for the 4th of July show, I played your version that you recorded of the Star Spangled Banner.
All right, Mark Ghana show. Yeah. Right.
But what you're talking about with like fiscally conservative states funneling so much money into these prisons, it goes back to this concept of like a human national-wide public health crisis. It's like this kind of like white supremacist culture and this addiction to it is just eroding our hearts from the inside.
I mean, the state of Louisiana spends more to incarcerate a man for a year than he's able to earn on a job.
Yes.
And that makes no sense.
Yeah.
Because he's not contributing to the economy. He's not raising children. He's not just functioning and useful to the people around him. He's picking cotton at 2 cents an hour, and that's rehabilitation for a person whose ancestors did the same thing. Like, how is that penitence? How is it rehabilitation? Like, what are we doing?
And it's so clear when you look at the history, like, as you say in your dissertation, like, Angola State Prison went from whatever 99% white to 80% black within a couple of years after the Emancipation Proclamation. Yeah. And I think that kind of stuff just lays it so bare on what's actually happening with the incarceration, the mass incarceration.
Even though it was still quite cruel before that, there was a, in a Victorian 19th century way, they were trying to rehabilitate people the best way that they knew how in their really repressed, kind of messed up way, as opposed to just cruelty for cruelty's sake.
Yeah. Just this addiction to white supremacist power and the trying to defend the idea of a white person as a default and a white man as a default to the destruction of that person.
Right. Because there were, I mean, there were 4 million people they did not want to offer full rights of citizenship to.
Yes.
And to this day, see how when the Voting Rights Act was gutted in 2013, where they removed all the provisions that called for federal oversight for any change in voting behavior, voting access or rights or whatever. And so you see how they can sort of roll back the clock to the era of grandfather clauses and literacy tests. Yes. While hiding it behind still having an amendment for voting rights, but not really having anything behind it to do anything, knowing that there's enough cultural memory and frustration to where a lot of people will sort of speak up for a second and then just walk away because that's the way it's always been.
Yeah.
And it's just a travesty. And they'll do anything to maintain power because they know 2050 tops, they aren't physically going to be the dominant culture anymore. And well, instead of getting all your kicks while people are still down, why not help them up and dust them off so that everyone's standing tall, as opposed to, you know that you're tall because everyone else is on their knees.
Dan, thank you so much for all your time and your wisdom. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you joining us.
You're one of my favorite people, man. Oh, just so you know, I found that Shel Silverstein cassette that you gave me like 15 years ago. It's in my little closet there. I was like, oh, I still have it.
I remember that. I had that. I'm like, the only person that's going to need this is Dan. Dan.
Oh, yeah. And then I remember I got it. I was like, Mom, this guy gave me this Shel Silverstein cassette. She's like, is it where the sidewalk is? And she was all stoked on it. But it's for the best that we roll because my computer's telling me that my battery's dead.
Okay, that's perfect. Hey, Dan, thanks so much. This is People Music by Gary Bartz. Thanks, Dan.
Don't need a partner to do it. You can dance any way that you see fit. People, come on, I want to see you dance. I want to see you dance. When you get the feeling that you can't go on, you just pick you a natural rhythm. Then you see that the dance is really lit. People, come on, I want to see you. I want to see your thing. Around the floor, then you begin to get excited. All around you becomes ignited. People, come on, I want to see you. I want to see you dance. I want to see you dance. I want to see you dance. Get when you're feeling you're in a tight one, yeah. You just hang in there and go right on. Right, give on. All I want to see get you on. I want to see you now. get to feeling, when you get to moving, when you get to grooving, all around the floor. Can't be nowhere around the floor. Then you begin to get excited. All around you becomes excited. All around you becomes excited. And then you get the feeling that you want to dance. And then you get the feeling that you want to dance. And then you get the feeling that you want to dance. Dance.
That was Gary Bartz with his song People Dance. Thank you so much to Dan Atkinson for your time and for all your brain power. Just really appreciate you coming on the show and giving us such great stories and wisdom. If you want to hear the full conversation, you can check out last week and this week's episode at KISU.org and then just find Don't Call It Jazz. You can listen to Don't Call It Jazz every first and last Saturday of the month at 7 p.m. Mountain Time. Many thanks to the station and to Jamin Anderson and to our sponsors over at ISU Credit Union. Until next time, thank you very much for lending me your ears.